From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. In books like Arctic Dreams, Barry Lopez explores man's relationship to the animal world and the landscape. He says he tries not only to expose readers to the natural world, but to try to bring them in balance with it. On this edition of Fresh Air, a talk with Barry Lopez. Also today, we meet actress Pamela Reed. She played Belle Starr in The Long Riders and the tough campaign manager in Tanner 88, the spoof of last year's presidential race. She stars in the new film Rachel River. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of composer Harold Shapiro's Symphony for Classical Orchestra. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg looks at the politics of bilingual education. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest Barry Lopez won the 1986 American Book Award for Nonfiction for Arctic Dreams, an account of his travels in the far north over a period of 4 years. When Lopez accepted the award, he said, "Even though I appear to write largely about the landscape and animals, what is in my gut as a writer is a concern for the fate of the country I live in and the dignity and morality of the people I live with." Lopez is also the author of the book Of Wolves and Men, a study of wolves and their powerful influence on the human imagination. The book is based on Lopez's travels through Alaska, but he actually raised two hybrid red wolves at his home in the Oregon woods. Although it was an extraordinary experience, he concluded that wolves don't belong living with people. All too often, the wolf's life ends tragically, or its potential for growth is smothered. Lopez has lived in the Oregon woods for 20 years. He grew up in New York City and in the San Fernando Valley. Lopez's latest book is a collection of essays chronicling his travels through North America. I asked him to read the conclusion of his essay, Gone Back into the Earth.
I had just come out of the Grand Canyon with Paul Winter, a musician, and the musicians that play with Paul, and another small group of musicians who had traveled along with us and several friends and whatnot. And we had had a very deep emotional experience, the group of us together, and then we all went our separate ways. And I was making my last connection to get home, sitting there in the airport in San Francisco, and wondering what really was it that had happened? What is the reverberation of all of this experience that we'd had together making music in the bottom of the Grand Canyon? And what I wrote was this: I do not know, really, how we will survive without places like the inner gorge of the Grand Canyon to visit. Once in a lifetime, even, is enough to feel the stripping down, an ebb of the press of conventional time, a radical change of proportion, an unspoken respect for others that elicits keen emotional pleasure, a quick, intimate pounding of the heart. Some parts of the trip will emerge one day on an album. Others will be found in a gesture of friendship to some stranger in an airport, in a letter of outrage to a planner of dams, in a note of gratitude to a nameless face in the park service, in wondering at the relatives of the ubiquitous canyon wren, in the belief, passed on in whatever fashion, a photograph, a cord, a sketch, that nature can heal. The living of life, any life, involves great and private pain, much of which we share with no one. In such places as the inner gorge, the pain trails away from you. It is not so quiet there or so removed that you can hear yourself think, that you would even wish to. That comes later. You can hear your heart beat. That comes first.
Do you think that descriptions of what it's like to be, for instance, in the Grand Canyon are really good reminders for readers who are sitting at home, maybe in the city or maybe in the country, but far away from things of such natural wonder?
Well, you hope as a writer that they're good reminders. The only way I can really answer a question like that is to think about my own responsibilities or what I feel when I'm in the places that I'm really privileged to travel. I've chosen a kind of life that allows me to go to these places. And when I'm there, I think a great deal about the reader who, for reasons of timing or having to take care of children or all sorts of obligations that impinge on all our lives, can't be there. So I hope it's not just a reminder, but that in some real sense, as a writer, I am there paying attention for the reader. In other words, I'm looking at things that are not only just of interest to me, but of interest to my what I think of as a community. So I would hope to do more than remind. I would hope that in what I see and in the way I'm able to put it together, to give the reader some sense of his or her own participation in that place, that it's not some distant geographic location to which they have no connection at all, a kind of an amusement or something at a distance, but something in which they have a personal stake.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that as the American landscape becomes more threatened, that this kind of writing becomes more important?
I do, but I think it's more than a kind of writing. What I see emerging in
yes.
in nonfiction is an attention to landscape, to the elements of landscape that we've known before in American fiction. It goes back a long ways, and we've known now in American nonfiction. But I sense a very strong and substantial interest on the part of people who before this might not really have been that much interested in the elements of natural history, because they sense in them that for 40,000 years we've been telling ourselves stories about how to live worthy lives in the world, and the metaphors that we've chosen most consistently have been the metaphors of natural history. I think it's more than just a kind of writing. I think many writers are sort of turning to look at landscape and the movement of rivers, or at developments in business and things like that, and taking landscape into consideration in a way we haven't before, in part because we sense that it's not just physically imperiled. There's something else here. There's some kind of substantial, I guess you would say, a spiritual issue at stake, and so I think a number of writers have begun to notice this.
One thing that emerges over and over again in your latest collection of essays, Crossing Open Ground, is your willingness to challenge sanctimony and self-righteousness and to take on moral ambiguities. And one essay I'm thinking about is about a trip that you went on sailing with biologists who were killing seals for research, for important ecological research. Why don't you describe the research they were doing?
It was necessary to unravel, if you will, the food web in this area in the Chukchi Sea along the coast of Alaska, and having done that, to see how animals related to each other there, how the food chains operated, so that the information could be used to develop a plan for oil drilling, oil exploration and drilling. So you had this irony where you had to take the lives of animals in order to protect the lives, ultimately protect the lives of animals.
Did you have your mind made up before joining these researchers about whether or not this was justified killing?
I never have my mind made up. Life is too unfathomable and too complicated for any individual to stand up and say that he or she has it all figured out. And what I look at as my responsibility is to go into the face of things that on the surface seem wrong and horrible and deranged, and say, well, yes, of course they are, and it is heartbreaking that these animals are going to be killed, as we say, for science. But what is really going on here? If I can't determine that as a writer, if I can't expose what's really going on, then it makes it even more difficult for people who are not there to use that information to clarify these issues in a court of law or wherever it is that they wish to go. I don't think a reader comes to a writer in order to know what is right or wrong. I think the reader comes to the writer in order to learn what happened. My job is to say, I went to a place and I tried to pay attention to what was going on in all its detail, and this is what I saw, and then turn to the reader as a member of the community in which I live and say, is this what we want? Is this how we want our world to be?
You describe on this research boat that we were talking about, after the killing of seals, everybody kind of cleaning themselves off, bringing back
yes.
no traces of blood, because on the ship there would be people who
yes.
would be very offended by that. There were people who were willing to go along with the research, realizing that it was probably important and necessary,
yes.
but were very offended at the deaths, nevertheless, that were taking place. And I wonder how that decision was arrived at. You know, if that was something that the researchers were very conscious that they were doing, or is that something that you read into their actions?
No, it's something we all did. I mean, what happened was we were working off a research vessel, and some of the people on that research vessel, rumors had preceded us that these two researchers were going to be killing animals, and it was, the rumors were, as rumors can be, things that were stretched all out of shape, and people had images of slaughter. And I spoke to some of those people, and I realized that they had very strong feelings about animals being killed for science. And I apprised my friends that I was with of that. And after that, nobody said a thing. But we all, I mean, it was just unspoken that it would have been grossly disrespectful on our part to have left that ship and gone off in the ice and hunted and done our work and with these animals, taking stomach contents and measuring them and doing all that kind of work. And then to have come back to the ship with any trace of blood in our small boat or on our clothes would have been... it would have been inexcusably rude mm-hmm. to do that. And so that's why we... But nobody ever... None of the three of us ever said a thing about it. It's just how you've got to behave with respect toward other human beings who don't have the same beliefs that you do.
My guest is writer Barry Lopez, who's best known for his book Arctic Dreams, which won a National Book Award in 1986. He has a recent collection of essays called Crossing Open Ground that will come out soon in paperback. In this recent collection of essays, you also write about watching the beached whales back in 1979
yes.
off the Oregon coast. And there were so many different kinds of people who had come to see the whales. And you write that there were ethical problems that beset the scientists, mystical considerations that occupied a lot of onlookers. But for the Parks Department, they had a real practical problem. How are they going to dispose of the dead whales?
Yes.
And the solution was they burned the whales. And yes. you describe a little bit of what that was like. And then you say that no novelists, no historians, no moral philosophers, no Melville scholars, no painters were there. Should they have been? I mean, would
yes.
you have liked for people like that to have been invited to
Absolutely.
Witness the burning of the whales?
Absolutely.
Why?
I think that all of the momentous events of our lives should be observed closely by a wide range of people. It is no longer sufficient for us just to send representatives of law enforcement agencies and journalists to the State Department of Government or whatever it is to witness these things. I am deeply suspicious of a government that cuts off, cuts its artists, for example, its dancers and its painters, as well as its intellectuals, its scholars, off from these kinds of experience. Now, on the other hand, I'd have to say that here you have a situation where 41 sperm whales have washed up on the coast of Oregon. They are, in the beginning, they're dying, and after several days, they're all dead. There's a health hazard here. There are all sorts of practical things that have to be solved, and the police really have no choice. They've got to limit the number of people that have access to the animals because we are also there are also fools and drunkards and irresponsible people among us who delight in torturing animals that are dying, and you've got to keep those people away. But it seems to me that we should at least think about in the context of these extraordinary events, the eruption of a volcano, the waging of war, that society ultimately benefits from a full range of minds addressing an issue like this, something that is this emotionally complicated. What I wanted to do in that story was, and it's a long piece in which I just wanted to stand very far in the background and interview the representatives of the different groups, the Park Service and the police and the scientists and, you know, the local people and whatnot, about what they thought about this. And part of what I was trying to say is that there is no best overall opinion, that if we're going to make good and sound decisions as a culture, we need to know more than just what we get in our newspapers and what we read in the police blotter and what our government officials tell us. It's not that those people are wrong, but that the message is not complete enough for us to make good decisions. I think now that you and I have talked about this a little bit, obviously something that is moving underneath our discussion is some kind of resolution with what we might call the other. When an animal like this, a huge sperm whale, washes up onto the coast of Oregon, you're face to face with a creature that lives, first of all, in a completely different environment than our terrestrial environment. And part of what I wanted to know is, how do we address the other? How do we address the strangeness of life? And in my travels with Eskimos and more recently traveling in Antarctica and northern Kenya and other places, that has been very much on my mind. How is it that we present ourselves to the other? How receptive are we to the thoughts or the feelings of the other, whether the other is a sperm whale or a Pintanjinjara, Aboriginal people in Australia, whoever it happens to be? How do we present ourselves? What draws me as a writer to these issues is, first of all, there is in my mind little or no separation between language and landscape. They're inextricably tied together. And language for me is a way to open up landscape and make clear in it the things that are really on the human mind. And those are the big questions. What is the relationship of the individual to God? What is the relationship of the individual to the state? What is the relationship of a man or a woman to his or her community? What are the responsibilities there? And as a writer, I find those things easiest to address in these metaphors that are my metaphors from childhood, which are natural history and anthropology and geography and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I think what I'm trying to do is the same thing writers have tried to do as far back as we go in Western history, and that is to find a way to present ourselves to the other, to that which is different from us, in such a way that we're not imposing our ideas, but proposing the best of what we have been able to develop in Western culture and offering it as a way of life. And in the same moment, creating an atmosphere in which the other can reach us, can propose to us, and in which we will listen to the other.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your writing, mm-hmm. your ideas, and your experiences, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Barry Lopez, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer Barry Lopez is my guest. His books explore man's relationship to nature and to the animal world. Arctic Dreams won an American Book Award in 1986. His other books include Of Wolves and Men, Desert Notes, and a recent collection of essays called Crossing Open Ground, and that will be coming out in paperback in just a couple of months. Barry, I'd like to ask you to read what I think is a very provocative paragraph from your epilogue of Arctic Dreams.
Yes. This comes in a passage in which I have been dealing with a problem that was very difficult for me, and that is trying to understand the hunting behavior of my host, these men I was traveling with from St. Lawrence Island. We were hunting walrus, and this is a kind of conclusion to some of those troubling thoughts that I had. No culture has yet solved the dilemma each has faced with the growth of a conscious mind: how to live a moral and compassionate existence when one is fully aware of the blood, the horror inherent in all life, when one finds darkness not only in one's own culture, but within oneself. If there is a stage at which an individual life becomes truly adult, it must be when one grasps the irony in its unfolding and accepts responsibility for a life lived in the midst of such paradox. One must live in the middle of contradiction, because if all contradiction were eliminated at once, life would collapse. There are simply no answers to some of the great persistent questions. You continue to live them out, making your life a worthy expression of a leaning into the light.
You know, I think that one of the things, in a way, you're getting at there is an argument to a simplistic notion that once ecology is restored, nature is good, people are good, mm-hmm. and things are simple and just. And your encounters with nature aren't like that at all. I mean, there are terrible paradoxes and really dark things that you encounter. And I guess what I'm interested in finding out is if your confrontations with the natural world have led from dark things that you recognized in yourself, or if you started to recognize those things in yourself more through your encounters with nature?
I'd be hard-pressed to answer the question, really, Terry. I think what happens, or what has happened to me, is that when I was a child, I spent a lot of time around animals and in the woods, and something I could never have articulated or even understood as a child was my sense that it was all right to feel that you fit there, that these things weren't exotic, they weren't the things of childhood, and that you dropped them and then became an adult. And as I grew older, and as I became, in a formal sense, a writer, that distance between myself as an individual and what we call the natural world, it never widened. And so, when I stood in front of something that was terrifying, or I stood in front of something that was beautiful, there was no separation in my mind about what human beings are. I recognized in the natural world the quintessence of human life. They weren't separated.
You've written that freedom from dogma gives meaning to the world's celebration of life. That,
yes.
That you don't want to impose on wolves your impression of what wolves should be like. They'll teach you what they're really like, and
yes.
You will learn from that. Were you ever attached to dogma, though, when you started writing about nature?
I would think certainly. I mean, the disabuse of dogma is part of what your whole life is about. You
mm-hmm.
know, I think part of the social function of the writer in this country, certainly, and probably in other countries as well, is to undermine that complacency that comes with dogma, with the notion that it's all been figured out. It is an enormously difficult thing to do, to lead a human life. This is a terrifically difficult thing to do, and to lead a life with any kind of grace, and the trouble that people have in their lives to strive to be worthy in their own eyes and in the eyes of their community. This is an incredibly difficult thing to do. And sooner or later you realize that this dogmatic notion that everything is black and white it just doesn't work.
You've talked about the difficulty everybody has of living with any grace.
Yes.
And you live in the woods yourself. And I was wondering if that has made it easier for you to live with that sense of grace.
I don't think so. In fact, I think it's been more troubling for me, really. I like many writers, I lived in a relatively quiet existence for a long time, and I had an intimacy with the landscape in Oregon where I live, and I came and went there on a regular basis, and I knew a great deal about the woods around my home. And then, as I was drawn away, I went up north for long periods of time to work on a book which eventually became Arctic Dreams. And at the moment, most of the time, I'm very far away from here, in Antarctica, for example, or in northern Kenya. So I don't spend very much time at home, and that's begun to trouble me. And I've begun to wonder about exactly where I'm rooted. And I think of my life actually as somewhat less graceful than I would like it to be, because I am such an itinerant at the moment. This is a period of time that has something to do with a book and will go on for several more years, but I don't feel that I move very gracefully in the world at the moment, because I'm away from my community, I'm away from home for long periods of time.
When you're traveling, for instance, with Eskimos, as you've done a lot over the years, do they ever say to you or convey to you that you think too much, that you're too moody.
Oh, sure. Uh-huh. Not that I'm moody. I remember one time this man put his arm around my shoulder and he says to me, you're always thinking. And it wasn't a compliment. What he was saying to me was, your mind is so actively engaged on a rational and analytic plane that you miss a lot of what is going on because you're too busy thinking about it. And that man taught me to just, in a sense, put my notebook down and become fully immersed in the place. He said, Barry, you're always talking about how necessary it is to pay attention, and you've got to pay even more attention than you think if you're going to see what's going on.
Mm-hmm. When you're out on a long trip and things are getting very physically uncomfortable, you're very cold or you don't have enough food or the kind of food that you'd really like, and maybe you were wishing you were actually home. Does that discomfort ever distract you from your larger goals, the ideas that you've been telling us about?
Oh,
or
yes.
Are you always able to keep in touch with the larger meaning that you're looking for?
No, I'm just as human as anyone else, and I have there's nights when the mosquitoes are tearing you apart and you can't sleep, or there are nights when it's so bloody cold you can't sleep, and you get very tired, exhausted, and there's nothing to do but go on. I mean, I've been in situations where it's so cold that everyone has thought the same thought. I hope nobody brought a thermometer, because if we knew how cold it was, it would be so depressing, it would be even more difficult to do what we're trying to do. But I guess during the day sometime, I try to, as a matter of ritual, in the same way you would keep a journal, I try to focus every day on my responsibilities, and even if I just get a few shreds out of it, to overcome the discomforts. I would also add that, these what we're talking about are really abstract notions, and the reader in the end doesn't care about, I think, these abstract notions of the other and ideas about that have certain political overtones or are about environmental problems. The reader only wants one thing. The reader wants a wonderful story. And if you can't tell the reader a wonderful story, then you're not writing. So when I'm traveling, what I'm thinking about primarily, 99% of the time, is the elements of a story. How can I make a story come out of this? And then, if there's anything worth listening to on my mind, as just another man or woman walking down the street, if there's anything that's really worth listening to, I won't be able to get it out of the story. It'll be buried in there. And that's the magic of that wild animal that we call the language. But when I'm in a state of discomfort when I'm traveling, I'm thinking that the thing I must do above all else is pay attention to the simple particulars of daily life, the temperature, the movement of air, the color of stones, the tone of voice when you hear one man speaking Swahili and another man speaking Turkana, and how they interact with each other, and what are the smells of these particular leaves, and how hot does this sand feel on the back of your wrist, and what is the color of that mountain that disappears into the same color of sky, and where is the line of differentiation? Those are the things that I think about, because if I don't have that, if I can't tell a reader what it was like, if I can't say to the reader, this is what happened, then the rest of it is just kind of philosophical speculation that doesn't fit anywhere in a real life.
Where are you off to next?
Where am I off to next? I'm going to the island of San Salvador in the Bahamas to dive, and then I'm going back to Galapagos to work on some material down there, and then I'm going back to the Northern Territory in Australia.
Well, I want to thank you so much for sharing some of your thoughts with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, dear.
Barry Lopez has been my guest, and he won an American Book Award in 1986 for his book Arctic Dreams. His latest book is a collection of essays called Crossing Open Ground, and that will be coming out soon in paperback. I'm Jerry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with film and TV writer Carl Reiner. He wrote and appeared in Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows and The Dick Van Dyke Show. His movies include Oh God, Where's Papa? And several Steve Martin films, including The Jerk, All of Me, and Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid. His new film is called Burt Rigby, You're a Fool. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. From the Old West to the Midwest. Coming up, we meet actress Pamela Reed. She played the dance hall girl Belle Starr in the movie The Long Riders. Now she stars in the new film Rachel River, set in a small town in Minnesota. Also, Lloyd Schwartz reviews conductor Andre Previn's recording of Symphony for Classical Orchestra, composer Harold Shapiro's work that was first performed 40 years ago. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines the academic and political debates that bilingual education continues to generate. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. A feisty John Tower today continued his public campaign to salvage his nomination, vowing to fight to the finish. NPR's David Malpas has details.
At a hastily scheduled appearance at the National Press Club here in Washington, Tower invoked the words of one of the heroes of the Alamo, saying, "I will never surrender or retreat." He said the bitter ordeal of recent weeks has been uncomfortable, warned about the future of power in Washington being exercised through character assassination, and stood his ground even under the most direct assaults on his personal life. The questions from journalists in the audience reflected the swirl of allegations about Tower, and one in particular produced an unusual public confession.
You said Sunday you've never broken a pledge in your life. Does this include wedding vows?
As a matter of fact, I have broken wedding vows. I think I'm probably not alone in that connection.
Tower said he regards the oath he made to abstain totally from alcohol as more than a promise. He called it a sacred vow. I'm David Malpas in Washington.
The somewhat less controversial nomination of Dr. Louis Sullivan as Secretary of Health and Human Services won overwhelming Senate approval today. The vote was 98-1. The sole dissenting vote was cast by Republican Senator Jesse Helms, who said he was disturbed that Sullivan has declined to take a final position on several abortion-related issues. The Senate unanimously approved the nomination of James Watkins to be Secretary of Energy. Testimony in the Oliver North trial resumed today. Retired General John Singlob said he and North agreed that as a White House aide, North was prohibited by law from funneling assistance to the Nicaraguan Contras. He said they agreed that Singlob would work with the Contras and North would merely be kept informed. But earlier in the day, Robert Owen testified that he made many trips between Washington and Central America for North, carrying instructions from the presidential aide for how the guerrilla war was to be fought and carrying maps and money. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals in Austin today threw out a capital murder conviction against Randall Dale Adams, the subject of a popular movie, The Thin Blue Line. NPR's John Burnett has the story.
The appeals court ruled that Randall Adams did not receive a fair trial, in part because prosecutors knew a witness had lied, yet they ignored it. Adams was convicted in 1977 for killing Dallas police officer Robert Wood when the policeman stopped him for driving with his headlights off. He received the death penalty, but the U.S. Supreme Court set aside the sentence, and the Texas governor later commuted the death sentence to life. At Adams' trial 12 years ago, a 16-year-old runaway named David Harris testified he was riding in the car when Adams killed a policeman. But at a hearing in Dallas in December, Harris, who's now on death row for another crime, said that he alone was in the car and holding the gun when it was fired. The documentary The Thin Blue Line uncovered new evidence and brought the case national exposure. Now, the Dallas County District Attorney's Office is reviewing evidence to decide if it will go ahead with a new trial. If not, Randall Adams goes free. In Austin, this is John Burnett reporting.
The Venezuelan government today raised public employee wages by 30% and temporarily cut work hours. It is an apparent attempt to curb 3 days of rioting by protesters opposed to the president's economic austerity program. Banks, schools, and public transportation were shut down today due to the unrest. The U.S. State Department today issued an advisory against travel to Venezuela, where 100 people have been reported killed in the latest unrest. Stock prices were lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 15 points to close at 2243.04. Declines led advances 4-3 on volume of 178 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 15 cents. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Composer Harold Shapiro's Symphony for Classical Orchestra was highly praised when it was first performed over 40 years ago. but then it was pretty much ignored. Now there's a new recording of the piece featuring Andre Previn in the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz says Previn should be praised for resurrecting this lively composition.
Harold Shapiro's Symphony for Classical Orchestra is very fondly remembered, when it's remembered at all. Shapiro was only 27 when he composed it in 1947, and it's an exuberant, eloquent, accomplished work. Its title actually suggests not so much the classical style of Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven, but the neoclassical style of Stravinsky's Symphony in Three Movements, Orpheus, and Apollo. In fact, one problem is that the spiky, syncopated rhythms and long-arched melodies of the Shapiro Symphony sometimes sound too much like Stravinsky. Shapiro himself has even been a little defensive about this indebtedness. But think of all those 18th-century composers who sound so much like Mozart and Haydn. Even Haydn and Mozart sound a lot alike. They learned from each other, and they reflected the style of their time. A good conductor, though, and repeated listenings help reveal Shapiro's uniquely quirky American qualities. You can hear how well Shapiro's 40-year-old symphony has aged on a recent recording from New World Records. 2 years ago, Andre Previn conducted the symphony with the Los Angeles Philharmonic. He was encouraged to do so by a program sponsored by AT&T called American Encore, a program that supports performances of neglected American music. The audience response was so positive that Previn did something extremely unusual. He scheduled the symphony again the following season. The new album is of a live performance recorded last April. The liner notes tell us that Previn has called the Adagietto, Shapiro's 15-minute second movement, the most beautiful slow movement of any American symphony. He's probably right. Previn's version is certainly convincing and nicely played. But there's an even better one. The very first recording of the Shapiro Symphony, released by Columbia Records in 1954, was conducted by no less than Leonard Bernstein. Every composer should be so lucky with a first recording of a major new work. That recording is still available on the CRI label, Composers Recordings Incorporated. I'd like to play you Previn's version of the beginning of the Adagietto. Then I'd like you to hear how much more beautifully Bernstein shapes and phrases it. Here's Previn. Now here's Bernstein's more personal, more moving version of the same passage. ¶¶ The sound, of course, is better on Previn's new recording, and you don't have to interrupt the flowing slow movement to turn over the record. Previn even includes an extra piece of music by Shapiro, his early 9-minute overture. But the first recording of Harold Shapiro's Symphony for Classical Orchestra is still incontestably the definitive one.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. One of last year's more innovative cable TV series was Tanner 88, a satire of the American presidential campaign written by Gary Trudeau and directed by Robert Altman. Pamela Reed played Tanner's tough, chain-smoking campaign manager. Reed is a versatile actress. In her first two film roles, she played a Mormon in Melvin and Howard and the dance hall girl Belle Starr in The Long Riders. In the new film Rachel River, Reed stars as a single mother barely making ends meet as a radio journalist in a northern Minnesota town. Though Reed has been living in New York for over 10 years now, she says there were things about the story of this small town that she could identify with.
I think that a lot of people feel that the time that they have on this planet is spent in solitary confinement, that they seem to be going through a routine but really not getting anywhere, or that the town they lived in has had its day, you know, and they want to reinvest in that area and make it better and make it their town. And I think that she feels that way, the character that I played. You know, she sort of felt lost, and it wasn't about moving away and going to Chicago or something. It was about making her life better in this town and making this town better because she was living a better life.
Mm-hmm. Did you spend any time in the Midwest, in small towns, before performing in the movie to get a sense of what life was like there and what the people were like?
Oh, yeah, well, I didn't grow up in New York. I grew up in Tacoma, Washington. I also grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland. But Tacoma is very much, certain parts of Tacoma are very much like this area. So I didn't feel like a foreigner there at all.
This character strikes me as being really different from a character you played in an earlier movie, The Long Riders, in which you played Belle Starr, the dance hall whore. And, this was a one who's really tough and really hardened. How did you prepare for that role?
You know, sometimes you work opposite really good actors, and all you have to do is react. And the actors in The Long Riders were of that caliber. And David Carradine was just so, he made it so easy when I worked off of him.
He played Cole Younger.
Yeah, exactly. And rhythmically and musically, in terms of the cadence of the lines, it was so easy to point, counterpoint him.
There's a gesture that I think was really very telling, and I'd like to know whether this was in the script or whether it was something that you just came up with. There's a scene where Belle Starr is naked in the tub in an upstairs room in the bar, and David Carradine, as Cole Younger, comes up the stairs and just kind of walks right in. He's looking for her, and she does this whole, well, here I am, and she's naked in the tub and just kind of sits up and opens up her arms and maybe her legs in this whole gesture of display. It's just the opposite of shyness. And I thought it was just the perfect gesture there. What's the story behind the gesture?
Well, I turned the film down 3 times because of this scene. I didn't want to do nudity. I had a big, big, big talk with my father about this. This was before my father died. And I said, you know, I just, don't want to do this. And we talked, and he said, well, then fine, don't. But we talked through the film, and I told him, you know, what was going on. And it was a series of bathtub scenes in the whorehouse that they didn't want to cut out. And it was, my father said, this isn't out of context, and people don't take baths with their clothes on, and the director has promised you that he will protect you. Well, when that day came around, my father had died, and David took me for a long walk on the lot, and he showed me a place where he used to live on the lot, and he told me about his life, and then they came and got us and said, you know, it's time to, you know, get undressed for the scene. And I came in, and they built a box set, so which meant that just who had to be there was there, just the camera crew, actually. And I got in, and I'd asked for a girl, one of the extras who I'd become friends with, to be there with me. And she was, and sat in the tub, and the water was cold. And David had to come in the door and burst through the door, and I had to grab my gun and say, most people knock, you know. And he just stopped, and he just looked at me. And he looked at me from my nose to my toes. And nobody did anything. And when he got to my face, I felt like Simone Signoret in her prime. I felt so beautiful. I knew I'd done the right thing, and it was at that moment that I fell in love with film and the absolute freedom that is allotted to you in that art form. I didn't feel exploited one bit. I felt beautiful. And it was true, when I saw the movie, I looked a little better than I do in real life. And and they just showed my back. I mean, it was fine. But it was a real turning point for me that day.
Wow. Yeah, you know, that scene, as I was describing it, like as you're revealing your body, you're revealing it to Cole Younger, to David Carradine, but not to the audience, because your body isn't really frontally on camera at all.
No, it's just about what happens in that room.
Yeah.
And it's not the kind of thing where you've got bodies all over the place for the audience to get some kind of vicarious thrill out of. It's not about that.
Would you still have the same hesitation if you were asked to do a nude scene now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would, yeah. Because a lot of nude scenes that women are asked to do are completely
exploitation.
Yeah. Yeah, they're silly, you know. So there has to be a reason for it.
Mm-hmm. What's your assessment of the kinds of roles you see written for women of your age in the movies?
Well, I get confused sometimes by a conservative ethic that's really been predominant in this country, certainly for the last 8 years. I'd like to see someone be a winner without joining the conservative ranks, you know, that the idea of success isn't necessarily holding up a big diamond ring at the end of the movie or getting a three-piece suit and being accepted by the boys. That's something that bothers me. On the other hand, I think that we're seeing a lot more women in roles that reflect responsibility and their passion and their intelligence and their independence, and I like that. So it's a mixed bag.
Do you think that you're offered particular kinds of roles? I always like to find out about actors, how they think they're cast based on their looks.
Well, with women, it's a problem because somehow men get older. I know actors that I've played opposite who probably won't play opposite me now because they want to play opposite younger and younger women. And a lot of my girlfriends in their 30s who are actresses do discuss that, you know, and that a man wants to be seen with a woman who's 22 rather than 32. It's just a fact, and I'm not saying that all male actors are like that, but there are enough out there.
Do you have other roles coming up in the near future that would be interested in hearing about?
Oh, I just, I did a film that's being edited now called Chattahoochee, and it stars Gary Oldman and Dennis Hopper. It's a great cast. Fran McDormand, Ned Beatty, a lot of really good people.
It must be really neat to work with such a good cast.
Oh, man, you know it.
Have you ever worked with an actor, I don't know, like maybe Gary Oldman or Dennis Hopper, whose technique was really different than yours and you had to realign yourself so that you could be on the same plane with them because their acting style was so different?
No. I guess maybe I've run into an actor or two where it was all about style, and then that's always tough because it shouldn't be about style. Technique is something that you leave. You know, you can stand at the bar and do all of your exercises before you go up on point and walk out on stage. But once you're out on stage, you're on point and you're doing it. It's mm-hmm. no time to do your bar work.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Pamela Reed's new film, Rachel River, is now playing in selected cities around the country and will open in many other cities by the end of March. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's the latest story you have on John Tower?
Well, we have the plot of this soap opera thickening day by day. Senator Tower, former Senator Tower, today in response to questions from reporters at the National Press Club, said, yes, he did break his wedding vows, but he added, I believe I am not alone in that connection. And he also said that he's going to fight on to the last. Just as at the Alamo, this Texan will go to a vote on the floor of the Senate. Not today, but there will be a debate and a vote.
What else do you have?
Well, we also have a report from Lucy Kraft in Tokyo about the problems that Japanese women face when they decide to work under their maiden names, married women.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Over the years, bilingual education has evolved into a hot topic of political debate. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has some thoughts on a new book that he says puts the issue into perspective.
A couple of years ago, I got an angry letter from a woman in Los Angeles about an article I'd written about bilingual education and language policy in the New York Times. She told how her father had immigrated from Hungary when he was 10 and had gone into an English language school where he didn't understand a word. Still, he'd worked hard and learned English. But now she went to her daughter's school and saw Hispanic children taking all their subjects in Spanish. And as she put it, don't they know this is America? She went on at some length, and she somehow managed to get Fernando Valenzuela into her argument, but that was her drift. I recalled the letter as I was reading a new book by Washington journalist James Crawford called Simply Bilingual Education from Crane Press. It's the fascinating story of how an academic debate over educational methods spilled over into a heated political controversy. It's understandable that people should find the theory behind bilingual education a little odd. If we want to bring non-English-speaking youngsters into the mainstream, shouldn't they go into English-language classrooms as soon as possible, the way previous generations of immigrants did? But as Crawford observes, it wasn't quite like that. In the first place, bilingual education used to be pretty common. At the turn of the century, more than 500,000 American children were receiving all or part of their instruction in German alone. And for immigrant children who were made to sink or swim, the attrition was fearsome. In 1908, the dropout rates for non-English-speaking children in English-language schools ran close to 90%. Bilingual education was reintroduced in the 1960s as a way of dealing with the children of the new influx of immigrants, most of them Asian and Hispanic. Instead of going straight into English-language classrooms, kids get instruction in content subjects like math in their native language while they're learning English as a second language. But the point of that instruction is to facilitate their transition to the English-language track. It's clear that you pick up a language more quickly if you know something about the subject matter. If you've already learned arithmetic in Spanish or Cantonese, you have a better shot at being able to figure out what words like minus or equal mean when you hear them in an English language classroom. Bilingual education was not particularly controversial when it was first proposed. Congressman George Bush sponsored one of the early bilingual education bills in 1967, and 6 years later, Governor Ronald Reagan approved California's first bilingual education measure. But beginning in the late 1970s, conservatives began to see the programs as a kind of affirmative action, or affirmative ethnicity, as one of them called it. Critics like Education Secretary William Bennett and Senator Dan Quayle charged that the method was really aimed at maintaining ethnic identity at the expense of assimilation. One Department of Education official described the programs as the new Latin hustle. This polarization of the issue has colored the way people evaluate the programs. The conservatives say that bilingual education has been tried and doesn't work. The liberals say that it does. Crawford concludes that it depends which programs you look at. The method seems to be highly effective when it's done right, with strong local support and trained teachers who are fluent in the language of the students. But it's often hard to find competent teachers, particularly for more exotic languages. Not surprising, given the overall level of American foreign language skills. As a result, a lot of programs are bilingual in name only. Right now, there are more than 600,000 students in California alone who speak little or no English. That's about 1 in 6. It's going to take a massive commitment of resources and ingenuity to help them move into the social and economic mainstream. We can't afford to let them be made the hostages of ideology.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. James Crawford's book, Bilingual Education, is published by Crane Press. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Thinking about buying a house? Then tune in for some depressing advice from humorist Alfred Gingold. He's the author of a new self-help spoof called The House Trap. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker tries to get over a post-Grammy depression, and along the way he reviews New Order's album Technique. And guest film critic Stuart Klawans reviews New York Stories, the three-way collaboration of directors Woody Allen, Martin Scorsese, and Francis Ford Coppola. So hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.